Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater. I am a State House reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Malia Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk to Senator William C. Smith, Jr., who is a Democrat representing Maryland's 20th district in Montgomery County.
Among other things, we'll get to know Senator Smith and his district a little better and get his views on the state budget and his legislative priorities this session. But first, we're going to take a look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting during this last week of legislative session. To start, there was an inaugural gala, and Larry Hogan 2020 speculation was invited. What do we need to know, Luke?
Well, for this one, I'm going to bring in my colleague, Pamela Wood, from the Sun State House Bureau. The two of us were together at the inauguration and then at the gala that night. And so here's my interview with Pamela. Okay, I'm joined now with my State House Bureau colleague, Pamela Wood. And we had the opportunity to go to not only the inauguration, but also the inaugural gala last week for Governor Hogan, the second two-term Republican in state history. Pamela, can you set the scene a little bit? Tell us, what were people wearing? What was the environment like? What were people eating, et cetera?
Sure. So we tracked down to Prince George's County to the MGM Casino at National Harbor. He chose to do the D.C. suburbs this time. His first one 4 years ago was at the Convention Center here in Baltimore. So it was at the casino, which is very large. I'd never been there before. It was in a large room that was dimly lit that had a bluish-purple kind of lighting in there. I'm sure that was not by accident. So there were people mingling around. It was black tie. So there were people in tuxedos, people in suits. Women were largely in dresses, very formal dresses, like better than you would see at a wedding usually. And they had stations set up. The food was pretty basic. It was sliders. There were sliders.
Or burger sliders.
Right? Yeah, burger sliders, chicken sliders, some salads. There were very long lines at the bars. And it was actually relatively low key. There was a band. The band was great. It was loud and it was dark. So it made the sort of mingling and chatting a little tricky. But it was pretty low key for a while until the governor came out.
Yeah, I think we probably felt a little underdressed, right? And we were wearing suits. Yeah,
yes.
It was very ballroom formal, and it was crowded, right? So the governor's about to come out, and it's 3,000 people are there, mm-hmm. and then everyone's packed around the stage, and then what happens?
So as it became clear the governor was going to come out, suddenly everybody packed in right in front of the stage, and there were two big screens on either side of the stage, and they played a video that was a highlight reel of the past about 5 years for Governor Hogan. If you'd seen his campaign ads, it was very similar, but a little more dramatic. The narrator was like the movie trailer narrator guy. And, you know, it flashed through his first victory 4 years ago, the inauguration with the snow, the cancer in the hospital, the whole thing. And it ended with him on election night, where he memorably said, "In a blue state with a blue wave, it turns out I can surf on a purple surfboard." And the video cut out and the music came up. It was Surfing USA, and Hogan comes out on the stage, sunglasses. He loves the sunglasses, carrying a purple surfboard, and the crowd just lost their minds. They just went nuts for that.
Yeah, it was a piece of high political theater or low political theater, depending on your opinion. But it was certainly a memorable moment in in Maryland politics.
Yeah, and it was crafted for the audience. I mean, this was largely Republicans. There were Republican lawmakers. There were a few Democratic lawmakers mm-hmm. there. We saw there were lobbyists. There were what I can imagine our political donors, actually a lot of people I didn't recognize, but these are people who are, you know, Larry Hogan's people, and they certainly appreciate it. I mean, they went nuts for the surfboard. They were all high-fiving. The governor went along the front of the stage, was leaning down, shaking hands. Everybody had their cell phones up. I'm sure if you have political friends, you've seen the pictures on Facebook. And our photographer who we worked with that night here from the Baltimore Sun, Amy Davis, made some really great images that are on our website.
And then earlier in the day, you were outside in the cold for the governor's speech, and also former Florida Governor Jeb Bush's speech.
That's right.
What left an impression on you after both men's remarks? Let's start with Mr. Bush.
Okay, so we didn't know what he was going to say. We had a preview of what the governor was going to say, but we didn't know how Jeb Bush, what his remarks were going to be. And he actually was very funny when he started. He definitely looked a little uncomfortable. Now remember, he's a former governor of Florida, and it was about 35 degrees outside. And he got up there and said, man, it was 65 degrees in Miami this morning, and there's few people I would leave paradise for. And Larry Hogan is at the top of the list. And that was it was funny. It was a good opening line. But the crux of his speech was basically, Larry Hogan is fantastic. He's the antithesis of Washington, and we need more leadership. We need people like Larry Hogan. And it was the absolute most ringing endorsement. It was very striking to me that he almost could have said Larry Hogan 2020, but he didn't quite – he didn't say that, but it walked right up to that line.
Right. And then the governor gave his speech, and he talked quite a bit about Washington.
Right. He did. And now this is not new for those of us in Maryland politics who cover him all the time. He also talked about the divisiveness in Washington and how we need to be bipartisan.
We argued without acrimony, negotiated without hidden agendas, and compromised without political posturing. We didn't demand Republican solutions or Democratic solutions. We sought out bipartisan common sense solutions that worked for the people of Maryland.
He gave the story of his father. His father, you'll recall, was a congressman, a Republican from Maryland, who was the first in the GOP to kind of break and publicly announce that he thought President Nixon should be impeached. And this was really part of Governor Hogan's origin story as a politician, you know, the respect for the father and wanting to follow in his footsteps. And now we've heard this before. He said this 4 years ago, right, at his inauguration. But national people really took notice of this, and some national observers saw this as a kind of a shot across the bow to President Trump.
No man, not even the President of the United States, is above the law.
Yes, the reaction from the Never Trump crowd was quite, I would say, maybe over the top enthusiasm. They
got
a little too excited. I mean, all of a sudden, there are like columns in the New York Times and profiles and Politico,
and, yeah. BuzzFeed. Yeah. I mean, everybody was just abuzz in this whole like Washington inside the Beltway world. But it was interesting to me as someone like, well, this is maybe he amped it up a little bit, but this is not new. This is the Larry Hogan we've seen.
He took it up a notch.
He did take it up a notch.
Yeah. But you're right. It's the same types of things he's been saying. In fact, if you look at his inaugural speech 4 years ago, you're going to see some of the same exact words.
Yeah. And we do hear it all the time. And recall, he voted for his father for president, right? His father was still alive at the time. He didn't vote for President Trump, this is all apparently new discovery to the Washington types that we've known here in Maryland for a while.
Right. But he did. And so I asked him, we were at the press conference the next day, whether he wanted to run for president. And he threw cold water on the idea, I think. But he didn't say no. He didn't say no.
Right. And then one of our colleagues followed up and asked him directly, well, do you plan to serve your 4-year term as governor? And what did he say?
He said that's the plan right now, but basically you never say never. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is he didn't say no. He's not saying yes. He didn't say no.
That's right. Great. Pamela, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
So we just heard Governor Hogan, some clips from his inaugural speech. And I think a lot of people heard these and saw somebody sticking their toe into the water of national politics a bit more. And I saw a lot of excitement from the Never Trump movement. Some might call it the hopeless Never Trump movement. And also what some are calling the center right. What were people saying
I think it's interesting you said about Hogan sort of putting his toe in. There is certainly a group of never-Trumpers who would like to push him in the waters of national politics. Folks like Bill Kristol, he was quoted in a political article saying that Hogan went out of his way to be a little bit more forward-leaning than he needed to be. He could have given a very good inaugural speech for a second term as governor without the father, without the impeachment, and without the contrast with Washington, so he knows what he's doing. Bret Stephens wrote an entire op-ed in the New York Times about the potential of Hogan 2020. And Jennifer Rubin, who's certainly part of that never-Trumper center-right group, said that Hogan certainly has the record and gravitas to stand up against Trump. He looks more like a linebacker than a blow-dry politician and excludes what she calls, quote-unquote, normalness. So this past December, I got a front row seat to Larry Hogan and his interaction with sort of the folks from that center-right Never Trump movement. He gave some opening remarks at the Niskanen Center's program, aptly titled Starting Over, the Center-Right After Trump. He talked a lot about the same sort of themes we saw emerging in the inaugural address, about bipartisanship, working across the party lines, and a new sort of revival of conservatism that didn't have all the problems associated with the sort of the Trump movement. You actually got to speak with Jerry Taylor, who is the head of the Niskanen Center, this week. What did he have to say?
Yeah, it was an interesting interview. I called him up, and I expected Jerry Taylor to be somewhat coy. But he was, you know, he was gave full-throated support to the idea that Governor Hogan would primary Donald Trump. He said he wants him to run, I think he said, with every fiber of my being, like a very, very dramatic phrase. You know, and I said to him, I pushed him, I said, isn't this a fool's errand? I mean, this is, sounds like a suicide mission to me. Trump is incredibly loved by the Republican base. Even Republicans in Maryland are very dedicated to Trump. A primary challenge from Hogan, wouldn't that fail terribly? And he said, you're looking at the landscape right now. I agree with your analysis right now. But a year from now, the Mueller let's set a different scenario. A year from now, the Mueller investigation continues to grind on. More people are charged. Maybe there are even charges against Trump himself. The economy has gone into a downturn sparked in somewhat by loggerheads in Washington and Trump's demand for a border wall. You have increasing reports of corruption coming out of the White House. The Republican Party is going to want to have a plan B. And in that void, you're going to need somebody who has a campaign apparatus ready to go, who has volunteers ready to go, who's got money and can begin to jump into the void. So that's why he wants to see Hogan ready. He also is very fond of John Kasich in Ohio and Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, also governors. And he thinks they represent a different center-right way forward for the Republican Party.
So, you know, with all the rumbling with the potential of a Hogan 2020 or perhaps any of those other individuals you mentioned as part of the sort of Never Trump movement, there was a quote in the political article that I thought was pretty interesting by Chris Carr, who is the Trump 2020 political director. He mentioned that any potential challenger should understand that the Trump campaign is better organized than any campaign in history, especially with the support of the Republican Party, which is firmly behind the president. And so this is the first, I think, quote that we've seen in the national media pushing back against the potential of there being a challenge to the president from the Republican Party.
Yeah, and Jerry Taylor at the Niskanen Center is even though he's not maybe a super well-known figure in American politics, he's really working on the governor. He's been meeting with him several times over a course of weeks. He's urging him to run. He came to the inaugural gala last week. He met Hogan for lunch in Annapolis 2 weeks ago. So he's pushing him. The governor, for his part, I asked him directly at a news conference, does he want to run? Is he planning to run? And he said his plan right now is to finish his term. But he always leaves the door open, and he's leaving the door open more and more recently. I think, you know, every politician loves attention and loves to be told you should run for this or that. So I'm sure there's a little bit of that going on as well.
Okay, as much fun as it is to speculate about 2020, we need to take a step back, back here to 2019. One of the big surprises before legislative session even started was that the recommendations of the much-talked-about Kerwin Commission would be delayed for another year.
Yes, and I sat down with our education reporter, Liz Bowie, who attended the Kerwin Commission's meeting on Friday, and we discussed what's happening with this perhaps the most monumental issue legislators are currently tackling. Okay, I'm here with my colleague from the Sun newsroom, Liz Bowie. Liz has been following the Kerwin Commission, and you covered the latest hearing of the commission, which, as we all know, is wrestling with some of the big issues about how we are going to make Maryland's schools into a world-class education system. What happened Friday? What is the latest from the commission?
So on Friday, they actually took the big step of voting on their final report, or their sort of final report, that lays out all of the policies changes they would like to see in the coming 10 years in Maryland in terms of education. And it's very ambitious. It calls for things like more expanded pre-kindergarten for both four-year-olds and three-year-olds, low-income three-year-olds. It also basically restructures the way high school would work, and it also has a lot of changes for teachers in an attempt to sort of make the profession more professional, both by paying the teachers more, but also by requiring them to meet sort of higher standards in general.
And as you know, we're all sort of digesting this massive report and exactly what it's calling for. As you talk with experts in the education industry, what are they saying that are some of the things that are really going to boost student achievement? And do they think that the committee has missed anything that should be in there?
I think that one of the things they think is very still problematic is the fact that they haven't decided how much will be paid by state government and how much will be paid by local governments of this incredible increase that they're asking for. And so that is going to have to be decided next fall. It's going to take them 9 months to wrangle, I think, with a variety of local governments and advocates to decide exactly how much is going to get funded by the state. I think that the proposals are pretty much agreed upon by a lot of advocates. They may quibble with different things here and there in the broader policy plan, but I think they're pretty satisfied.
And there's a big emphasis, like you said, on early childhood education.
There is.
It seems like the committee, not to say that's the only thing, but they zeroed in a lot, as that is something that other countries with very successful education systems are doing much better than we are in America.
Yes, but I think they also looked broadly at, like, they really went and dug into what are the highest performing educational systems in the world and what can we take from those, what ideas can we steal and sort of adapt to Maryland. They say they've done that, and I think we'll see whether that can be done and whether, you know, sort of how much pushback they're going to get from local government.
And then one thing that I saw mentioned, I covered one of the hearings maybe a month ago, was that and there was some research done by EdTrust, that the most underfunded school systems in the state by their research were all majority students of color, and that the more students of color a district had, the more underfunded it is. Did the commission talk at all about why that is and what they're doing to try to address it?
So I think they are trying to address it. I think that a lot of what their focus is on sort of closing the achievement gap between rich and poor students and students of color and white students. That has been a sort of intractable problem throughout the nation, really, but it's particularly bad in Maryland. That happens because most local school systems that have large numbers of students of color tend to be the cities and urban areas where there's less tax base. And so there's less money for those local governments to put into education. So they have been underfunded for years.
Liz Bowie, the Sun's education reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Speaking of education, Governor Hogan's budget came out last week, and the thing he touted the most was, once again, what he calls the record spending in education funding. It's always a topic of debate between the Democrats and the governor on whether or not he is a supporter and a champion of education.
So I actually had a little bit of deja vu on Twitter yesterday. Thanks to Delegate Eric Luedtke, one of the General Assembly's most prolific tweeters. Almost immediately after Governor Hogan released his budget proposal, the delegate tweets, "Governor Hogan is releasing his budget proposal today, and the Hogan spin cycle is in full effect. For the record, the quote-unquote record education funding he is touting is mandated by the legislature. He's bragging about doing something he's already forced by law to do." And this back and forth between the governor and the General Assembly feels almost never-ending. So, Luke, can you fact check this? What's going on here?
Yeah, sure. There are, I think, three major points of view on this issue. The first is the governor's, who says, look, I'm funding more money for education than ever in Maryland history. That is in part because Maryland's population continues to rise. And frankly, every budget rises, right? So you have more people paying taxes, you have more kids in the schools, so therefore you have to spend more money. So the Democrats will come back and say, well, look, a large portion of the budget, almost all of it, is mandated spending by the legislature. So he's just taking credit for things that we passed, that the Democrats passed. We say he has to spend all this money on this stuff. And so for him to take credit for it is like taking credit for the sun rising. That said, the governor did add in more money than what was required by the legislature's funding formulas. For instance, Baltimore City in particular would have gotten an $11 million cut. They do not have the cut. The governor proactively put in the $11 million to make sure that they have the same funding as last year. I think he's very attuned to the fact that he gets tremendous blowback at any time he cuts the city schools. We've had cuts in the past couple of budgets, and there were large protests and rallies, and eventually the governor did add in funding, but it took weeks for him to do it. So I think he was proactive this time. He didn't want to have that fight. And I guess the third point of view I would say is the view of Dr. Sonia Santelises in Baltimore City and the education advocates who say that Baltimore and other really predominantly minority or black school systems have been chronically underfunded by the state. There's some research that supports that. There was a study released to the Kerwin Commission a couple years ago that said Baltimore is underfunded by about $290 million a year, and the Kerwin Commission is trying to remedy that by increasing funding by a great amount. Something like probably $300-400 million more a year for Baltimore City. So there are very points of view, and everybody kind of has a point. I think in the end, what matters to most people is are the kids able to learn? Are the class sizes small enough? Are the buildings not falling into disrepair? And I think that if you walk through the halls of any Baltimore school, except for maybe the new ones, you're going to see these are places that could use a lot more funding, not less.
Now, I think, listen, this is an absolute example of the sort of infighting that goes on within Annapolis circles. But as a pollster, and I would tell you about, like, public opinion in Maryland, people are more likely to react to things exactly what you're saying about reports of public schools and sort of disarray and reports of sort of the large dollar amount of funding. They're more likely to react to that than they are to react to the sort of back and forth between members of the state legislature and the governor. Okay, so as much fun as it is to talk about budgets, after all, they are a reflection of your priorities, we need to pause and welcome our guest. And today, we're going to speak with Senator William C. Smith from Maryland's 20th District. He's the vice chair of the Judicial Proceedings Committee. Thanks for coming on Roughly Speaking, Senator.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so first, I'm going to give our listeners a quick walk through your electoral history. So the 20th District is really progressive. Only about 11% of your voters voted for then-candidate Trump back in 2016. 83% went for Clinton. That's a 72-point spread. So Governor Hogan fared a little bit better last November. He earned 27% of the vote in the 20th. Ben Jealous, the Democratic nominee, earned about 71. Now, you ran for the first time back in 2014. You came in third, just a hair behind David Moon. In 2015, you were then appointed to the Maryland Senate when Jamie Raskin won the Democratic primary for Congress. And you ran unopposed this last primary election cycle for your Senate seat. And you won 91% of the general election vote.
There
congratulations.
Thanks, appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about your district, Senator.
Sure. Well, District 20, as you mentioned, is a very progressive district, a very liberal district. It's Tacoma Park and Silver Spring. So Tacoma Park is obviously the Berkeley of the East Coast, or I mean, Berkeley is the Tacoma Park of the West Coast. But formerly represented by Jamie Raskin, Heather Mazur, Tom Hucker, who have all gone on and done wonderful things. Obviously, Jamie's in Congress. But District 20, I think, is the third highest DPI, the Democratic Performing Index, maybe two districts in Baltimore City and then one in Prince George's ahead of us. So maybe we're the third or the fourth. Definitely the top five Democratic Performing Index in the state. So it's a very progressive, very blue district. And as you mentioned, the governor overperformed there. So some interesting dynamics in Montgomery County and in the district. You had people vote for Larry Hogan, but then turn around and vote for Jamie Raskin and then Brian Frosch. So an interesting dynamic this last election cycle.
Great. Okay. So oftentimes the work that you do in Annapolis is not sort of state-centered. It's district-centered. So you can tell me a little bit about some of the legislation that you passed that directly benefited your district?
Sure. Well, you know, last year, a huge focus is on the Purple Line and helping mitigate some of the efforts for the construction that's going on for the Purple Line, which is a strip of, basically a transit line that will go from College Park all the way to Bethesda, but most of the stops are in District 20. And so we had some legislation that would have helped defray some of the costs for tax relief for some of the businesses there. That was unsuccessful, but it did prompt action locally. And so the county council has stepped up and helped with that as well. Got some also local stuff. Big deal this year is the highway expansion. So Delegate Al Carr and I are working on a bill that would require the governor to seek the approval from the local jurisdictions before they go ahead and have a toll road. This is something that's already in place in the law with nine other counties on the eastern shore. So that's something that's been done before. So things like that. Those are more local. But the folks in the district really look toward our delegation to not only represent locally, but also to pass things statewide. So there are a couple things that I'm working on this year that will have a statewide impact, but are really driven by some of the input that I've gotten locally. Those are things like the end of life option, so right to die, that's coming up. The Home Act, which is source of income discrimination, which is something that doesn't exist in Montgomery County, doesn't exist in Tacoma Park, but something that I hear a lot about for housing advocates. And then also the 287G program, which Stuart Pittman went ahead and abolished as soon as his second week in office. That's something that we've had a heavy immigrant population in my district, and that's something that they'd like to see implemented statewide. So lots of things that are driven from our very activist community that affect us.
All right. So your community certainly is much different than the communities, the folks who represent Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore, very different groups of folks with different political ideologies. So can you tell me a little bit about where you have some overlap with those individuals and where there's points of contention between sort of you and the delegates and senators who represent other sort of non-Tacoma Park parts of Maryland?
Sure. I think one overarching, that's why I love the Veterans Caucus, because it gives you an opportunity to really engage in issues that it's bipartisan or nonpartisan. So whether in Washington County or Montgomery County, Hartford, Charles, you're going to have respect and support for our veterans, and that's something we've got 380,000 veterans in Maryland all throughout the counties. So Democrats, Republicans come together every year to try to make Maryland the most veteran-friendly state in the nation. So we've got a couple of big bills I think that will make significant impact for folks, especially returning from active duty. Every day across the nation, two veterans commit suicide every day, and so we've got some bills that will help address that issue. The opioid crisis, obviously, there's some significant overlap there. So there are a lot of things like that that we can come together on.
Great. So let's circle back then to the military service. So you, along with Representative 20th District, you also currently serve as a lieutenant in the United States Navy Reserve. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Are you from a military family?
No. So I was a sophomore in college when during 9/11, and a lot of folks, two folks in my high school, went on and served right away. One actually was killed in action. And so I was kind of inspired that way. But frankly, you know, I'm a first generation college student, first person in my family to go to college. And so to graduate from college, with my mother's children. And she was very adamant that I was not going to go enlist or go to officer candidate school until after I finished my education. And so in my third year of law school, I did a direct commission and now serve in the reserves as a DIA unit down at the Pentagon. And so, you know, we're always subject to being deployed. And so even we're doing some drawdowns in Syria and in Afghanistan, our unit has been pulled a lot to help support the efforts, especially Operation Resolute Support in Afghanistan. So that's something that I'm keeping a close eye on as members of my unit have been deployed.
So I think what's really interesting is that at one point in time, particularly I think in the 70s and 80s, military service was a sort of must-have for candidate characteristics. So if you wanted to run for Congress, you had served in the military. The number of military, active duty military and veterans has plummeted in the U.S. Congress. As a matter of fact, it's down to around 20% now. Do you but in this last election cycle, sort of there's a number of like high profile Democrats that have been running in these swing districts who are military veterans. Do you think that the Democratic Party would be smart to start looking for individuals with military service to tap to run for public office?
Absolutely, especially at the national level. I mean, the trend is actually ticking up now. I mean, since the World War II generation, so the Greatest Generation and then Vietnam, we've had kind of a decline. But now in this latest freshman class nationally, we've had a surge, especially on the Democratic side, of folks that have military service. And then that happened here in Maryland as well. We have more folks coming in. You know, we've got some folks that have three tours of Afghanistan on their resume. These are Democrats that have defeated Republicans in swing districts. So we've got a lot of good folks that we're building a bench with military background. Nationally, obviously, it makes sense because you're focused on foreign policy. But I think locally, it gives you a humility and a worldview that you can bring to local service. That I think is needed and something that can definitely benefit folks in, especially on the Democratic side, but in local, state and local office. It's a tremendous benefit.
How has it changed your worldview serving in the military?
I think because you're more aware globally of how things are interconnected. And when you bring that down, so for instance, I mean, my unit is a unit that supports NATO. And so I understand the value of international institutions like NATO and the EU and the stability that they've brought toward the global space. If you look, then draw those lessons that you can, bring down to the state and local level, you understand that things are interconnected. So when you talk about the red line or the purple line, that's directly connected to housing. That's directly connected to access to education and access to your job. And if people want to talk about building the middle class or raising the middle class, all these things are inextricably linked. And I think that gives you a little bit of the background to understand how things are connected, but also, again, the humility of service, public service in general, but at the highest level, which I think military service is the highest level of public service, I think does give you a sense of humility and purpose.
And you alluded to it earlier, but what's the main priority this legislative session for the military, the Veterans Caucus?
It's awareness for suicide prevention. And last year, Senator Steve Wall sponsored a bill which had 100% approval in the Senate. But there was a small little tinker. It went to the Department of Veterans Affairs instead of the Department of Health. This year, we're going to fix that. That should pass again. That's a number one priority that essentially allows for veterans to have access to quality care and healthcare prevention for suicide prevention and awareness. We also have a bill that would have a day designated to suicide prevention. So those are the two big priorities, but lots of other things coming too.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I'm going to turn it over to Luke.
All right, sounds good.
So you talked a little bit about your legislative priorities. One thing I wanted to hear more about, because this is an issue that's affected a lot of people in Baltimore, and that is the fear of deportation. I covered a case a couple years ago right after President Trump became president, and there were a couple of really pillars of the community in Southeast Baltimore who were rounded up and locked up, and their families were terrified that these kids, that their kids were going to be sent back, or they weren't going to get to see their dads. Explain to us what your bill would do and how it would address these problems.
Sure. Well, there are two parts. There's a little bit of background there. Last session, I worked with Delegate Carlos Sanchez from Prince George's County to put a bill, a standby guardianship bill, which essentially addresses some of the new realities that we have to live in under this administration and the immigration policy that it's chosen to implement. And that would have allowed for the children of family of parents that are deported to have someone as a standby guardian, someone that would then step in and make some of the tough legal decisions. That's for health care or for education decisions and the care and feeding of the child, the minor child, if their parent gets deported. But this year, we're focused on the 287G program, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but County Executive Stuart Pittman from Anne Arundel County took a very bold step, and he ended the 287G program. This is a program that is essentially allows for collaboration with state and local law enforcement to collaborate with federal immigration officials to implement ICE detainers and then commence with the deportation process. That has instilled a level of fear in the immigrant community. It has also taken resources, critical resources, away from state and local law enforcement that could be focused on real crime fighting as opposed to the immigration fight. Being here undocumented is a civil offense. It's something you can't be arrested for and detained for, certainly. So if you are arrested for something and then held on an ICE detainer, that's a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights, and it's essentially a new arrest, and you need probable cause for that. The Fourth Circuit has ruled on this, and circuits across the country have ruled on this and awarded some significant fines and fees or judgments against local jurisdictions that choose to go forward with this immigration policy. So what this bill will do is just end that because it doesn't make us safer. It's not a smart approach for crime, and it ends up having an adverse effect for our communities, our immigrant communities across the state. So that's essentially what it is.
So no jail in the state would be able to hold immigrants at the request of ICE beyond the orders of a judge.
Correct. I mean, if you are a danger to society or yourself, you're going to be held. And
right.
If you have a pending charge or if there's something, if you're a threat to society, you have the probable cause and local jurisdiction can hold you for that. So that's essentially right. I mean,
right.
I don't want folks to get out of the scope of being fearful that dangerous people are MS-13 gang. I mean,
right.
This is the type of bell ringing that, or hand ringing that, that doesn't help. It's not helpful.
Right.
These are really nuanced issues.
Sure.
That take a really sophisticated approach, and folks that engage in that type of hyperbole do a disservice to the voters and to the folks that are supposed to be serving.
Yeah, and in fact, we know all the research shows that immigrants, documented or undocumented, commit crimes.
Yes.
At lower rates than we Americans do.
Right? Native-born, yeah, exactly right.
Right. The other thing, was there anything else that we didn't ask you about in your session priorities that you wanted to highlight?
Sure. The HOME Act is, I think, significant. That would end source of income discrimination across the state. And what I mean by that is the legal source of incomes. So you could have alimony, Social Security, but it's really the voucher, that Section 8 voucher. And in the city, that's been a very controversial issue. But in Baltimore County, it's been an even more controversial issue. And I think there are some real, there's some underlying issues there that are cultural, social, racial, that are not often talked about. But when we put a bill forward like this, that's something, it's got to be a critical piece of the conversation, because if we don't address those issues, then we're kind of talking around what's really underlying the issues. But essentially, this bill would allow for folks that have a housing voucher to go anywhere in the state, especially towards zip codes of opportunity. So if I am, and the average, most of the voucher holders in Maryland, 70%, something like 70% are single mothers that hold down a job. They're giving it their all every single day. So if they want to try to find housing that's closer to their job across town or closer to a good school district, they are now precluded from that opportunity because of this law. Especially in Baltimore City. I mean, Baltimore City used to have an office of segregation. I mean, we have a really rich history of this here. And so this is one of the vestiges that I think we can kind of chip away at. I'm not saying it's transformative civil rights legislation, but it's something that would definitely open the doors of opportunity for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody now realizes Baltimore's biggest problem is the entrenched concentrated poverty.
Yeah.
And what all that segregationist policy has the chickens have come home to roost.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And then, and forgive me for always asking political questions,
but, no, it's all good.
But your name is bandied about quite a bit these days as a rising star in the Democratic Party, and even on some short lists of people who might be interested in higher office 4 years from now. What do you see next for you?
I'm really focused on seriously state Senate stuff. I'm focused purely on state stuff, though. So I will say this. I have no interest in going to Congress or the U.S. Senate. I really love state politics, and I would love the opportunity to serve in whatever capacity that there's an opportunity to make a greater impact. I think one thing you see in the House is that you get to the House and you're excited and you can make an impact and you're one of several members of the committee, but then you get to the Senate, it's a smaller pool, maybe you have a little bit more influence, a little bit of leverage to do some good. If you go a little higher up, lieutenant governor, governor, attorney general, then you have even more opportunity to do some good things. So those are great opportunities. But we'll see what the next 4 year holds. I'm just really excited to serve in the capacity of vice chair in the Senate. As was mentioned before, you know, I was elected in 2014 and then was appointed in 2016. So I'm still getting used to the Senate, really loving the work there. It's a really great opportunity to do work that is uncommon. I mean, not very many people get to do this type of work. And it's really lucky. I mean, I feel so lucky every day to be able to do this type of work. It's really fun. So
great. Senator, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's all we have this week on Roughly Speaking Government Edition. Thank you for listening, and may all your bills make it past the first reading.
And if you like what you heard, please find us and subscribe wherever podcasts are found. And while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't, so please consider subscribing to the Baltimore Sun at www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks, and see you next week.